Hello, I'm Brian.
I'm Caroline.
This is the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
podcast.
That third voice was our colleague Alex Grogston. Hey, Alex, welcome back to the podcast.
Hello. It's been a few minutes, hasn't it?
It's been a while. Last time was at the end of March. It's been a
while. Well, the insurance paid up without a fuss, and I'm allowed out on my own again now. So here I am.
And then you were talking about how China's approach to the coronavirus differed from ours.
Yes. Yes, we were at the height of the first wave of the pandemic back then, which is, I'll say, better best forgotten, but I don't think anyone can really forget the past 12 months, can they?
Does seem like an eon ago. On this episode, we are again missing our brilliant colleague, Claire McDonald. I'll be back in due course, and no doubt we'll be listening to this podcast. Oh, and welcome back to you, listener, most important person. The last podcast, we had a chat about, and we had Seb on, we had a chat about what we're looking forward to most in the after times, after the lockdown has finally gone. So we thought we'd ask you, Alex, what are you looking forward to most and proper post-lockdown?
I'm a big theatre goer, actually a young patron of the National Theatre in London, which is not as exciting or as expensive as it sounds. But I cannot wait to get back in there from June the 2nd, they're reopening. They're reopening with two plays, and I think I have tickets for both of them. One's called Afterlife by Jack Thorne, and the other is Under Milk Wood with Michael Sheen and Sean Phillips.
Oh, that sounds good.
And I'll be heading into the Tate as soon as I'm able as well. And I'm hoping to get an away day to go up to Manchester to see the Grayson Perry exhibition.
Oh.
It's a lockdown art club, which second series of which was on Channel 4 a few weeks ago.
A proper kind of cultural smash and grab everywhere.
Yep. Yep. Everything I can. I've missed it a lot. I've even missed the coffee in their cafes.
Yeah, we have been really starved of theatre and art galleries and stuff. You're not at all nervous about getting back into theatre. I must admit, I am a bit.
I was lucky enough to be able to go during the sort of 6 weeks or so that they were open in between lockdowns one and lockdown two. And we saw another new play called Death of England, probably about 3 days before the second lockdown at the end of October.
Yeah.
They were very well set up, socially distanced, seats blocked off, but all very easy to move around. It all felt very safe, and you could still get a glass of wine at the bar.
Oh, cool.
So I'm hoping it will be similar to that.
Yeah, I think it helps if you've done something during that kind of intermission period, like getting on a train or whatever, just to be through the experience is good.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll be fully vaccinated from a couple of weeks from today, so. Yeah. Booked my second dose the other day.
Oh, right. I had my second dose a couple of days ago. Caroline is shaking her head.
Yeah, I've still got until the end of June for my second one. I saw quite a good TikTok the other day by the comedian Rob Beckett discussing how all these people who have already had their second jabs are getting really cocky in supermarkets, you know, sort of walking around without masks on, just like having it large. And it's like, oh, I wish I could be that annoying, but I haven't had my second one yet, so I'm not allowed.
The CDC in the States has now said that fully vaccinated people can, in fact, stop wearing masks, which I'm not going to do just yet.
No,
I'm going to keep mine a little bit longer when I go out. And possibly bring them back during the winter because it seems like the thing to do now.
Mine's leopard print I wear, and I quite enjoy just like walking into a supermarket pretending I'm in some terrible Guy Ritchie film and like I'm about to rob the place just with a mask on and sort of get a bit of a strut and that's how I'm passing the time.
And we're all going to be meeting up relatively soon, the Computer Weekly team and Microscope as well, just before the bank holiday. That'll be interesting. We all see each other in person again.
Mm.
In the flesh.
Yeah, I haven't been on a train since my last visit on a train when just before lockdown one, so I am a little bit apprehensive about all that, but I'm signed up to go, so we'll see. Mm.
It'll be interesting to see the rest of everybody after having seen just Head and Shoulders for over a year now, to remind myself that we all have legs.
Yes, it may be overwhelming. Oh, we shall see. Let's crack on. So just to say where we're going in this episode, Alex, you've been at a super secret squirrel conference some of this week.
Yes, I was at the National Cybersecurity Centre's Cyber UK 2021 conference, which should have been happening in Glasgow, I believe, or possibly it was either Newport or Glasgow. I can't remember which. Obviously, it went virtual this year. It went on hiatus last year completely. It didn't happen, but we're obviously starting to get back to normal. So they ran their annual virtual conference this week with the theme of building a more secure and resilient UK after the pandemic. Lots of great speakers, including their new CEO, Lindy Cameron. The CEO of SolarWinds was there as well. Multiple other people from the NCSC's technical teams, and Neuberger from the US, who is Joe Biden's national security advisor. She called in from Washington DC to take part in a panel session.
Wow, sounds very starry.
Glittering. And really, the overarching theme, if I was to pick one out, would be the need for global and international collaboration on cybersecurity. And I think we've reflected this in some of our coverage of the event this week, and it's almost a no-brainer given the variety and number of devastating would be the word cyber attacks that we've seen in the past 5 or 6 months. We've had
There's been a ton of
SolarWinds. We've had the Microsoft Exchange attacks. We've had Colonial Pipeline this week. It just seems to be getting worse and worse. Pleased to see and pleased to report is that there's a groundswell of support for this increased information sharing across public and private sector response and so on.
Yeah, well, more on that soon. Caroline, one episode last year, you talked about the Chelsea Flower Show, and today you're talking about bees.
Yeah, the data centre community in Ireland specifically is coming up with a plan to do its bit to help support the falling population of pollinators, which is a lot harder to say than I anticipated, including bees. A lot of the island's native bee populations are under pressure, as they are in many countries. And so, yeah, the data center community have decided, this is something we want to help reverse the decline of.
Interesting. Okay, more on that a little bit later. I'm going to talk about, towards the end of the podcast, the Red Cross and their use of digital mapping, but it's as much about open data sharing and collaboration. So there's going to be some common themes, I think, throughout the podcast today. We shall see.
Well, let's start with the SolarWinds attack from last December, which was a Russian state-backed hack of SolarWinds' Orion network management platform that was used to attack US government agencies and other organizations. And SolarWinds itself since then has been remarkably transparent given the circumstances about its investigation and the steps it's taking to make things right. See multiple previous stories on Computer Weekly for more on that. Anyway, their CEO, Sudhakar Ramakrishna, was one of the first speakers up at Cyber UK this week, discussed the progress made so far. But what interested me from his talk and what I picked out was the fact he's speaking actively with some industry leaders to potentially form a consortium of mid-sized companies that could act in unison against malicious actors, possibly even take on a nation state. I don't know how much success he's having in that venture. I don't know if he's got anybody interested or if anybody's on the hook, but it would certainly be a new one, because you see, and SolarWinds being, a cyber adjacent company, if not a cybersecurity company, it would be well aware of this. You see, all of these different companies have all their different threat research teams and units and run their own blogs and often seem to be talking at cross purposes with one another. So you see the same information coming from Unit 42, which is part of Palo Alto's. You see coming from McAfee, as you see coming from Sophos or Checkpoint or FireEye's Mandiant unit. They all follow the same threats and actors, and they all pump out this information. But sharing that information better across the community, I agree with Ramakrishna and think it could be really valuable as a means to act with one voice. And if we start bringing in government agencies such as the NCSC or the CISA in the United States, then that becomes much more powerful. And that brings me on to Joe Biden's executive order signed the other day, which effectively mandates or will mandate better information sharing between public and private security organizations within the US. And obviously where goes the US, we will follow, is a fairly safe bet. So I'm optimistic that this could be a significant moment in the cyber community. It could be game-changing in terms of how we collectively respond to cyber threats.
There were some policy announcements at the conference. Dominic Raab was speaking.
Dominic Raab delivered a speech on the second day of the conference, in which he committed to investing £22 million in establishing enhanced cyber capacity in developing and vulnerable countries in the global south, in developer countries in Africa and Africa and Asia and so on. And the UK government's position over the past few months has been that the UK very much wants to be seen now as a leader in establishing rules-based international norms in cyberspace. There is a feeling that we are at risk of allowing countries that, to put it diplomatically, don't share our values to have it all their own way. So it's as much a hearts and minds exercise as it is a collaboration exercise. But there is, again, that idea of collaboration and cooperation that if we, you know, establish and work with poorer countries on cyber issues, we can stand up collectively to take action, protect companies and protect consumers across the world, as opposed to just in our own backyard.
£22 million, I think, was the figure.
£22 million, yes.
Yeah.
Do you get a sense that, you know, there is a lot of talk going on here about collaboration? Does it tend to be an industry that delivers on it, or do they sit around talking about, oh, we should be doing this, we should be doing that? But do you ever see much action or progress on these things?
Cybersecurity people, and God love them, because there's a lot of great people, they do like to sit around and talk. So I don't know, would be the honest answer to that question. Yeah. But I feel that things have reached a head in terms of threat volumes and incident volumes in the past 12 months, particularly during the pandemic, that there's now almost an imperative to take action, that we can't keep on keeping on as we did before. The Colonial Pipeline attack, as an example, seems to have been, you know, a real wake-up call to a lot of people, particularly in the US. And I would argue that the wake-up call should have been cyber attacks on hospitals during the pandemic, as opposed to the supply of fossil fuels that damage the global climate.
Yeah.
But I'll take what I can get. If more people are talking about it, more people are inclined to take action.
And that disrupted fuel supply, these pipes that go from, was it New York to somewhere in Texas, actually disrupted?
Yes, I believe their infrastructure links the oil fields in Texas to the eastern seaboard of the United States. So through the deep south and up the mid-Atlantic.
Yeah.
Mid-Atlantic states to New York. But there were petrol stations left without fuel, gas stations left without gas. People panic buying, filling up jerry cans. So there have been real world implications from this attack. But and that's also spurred the severity of the US response, I think, because take away their cars and, the economy there grinds to a halt. It's utterly car dependent.
Is the stuff, Alex, that should be happening or could be happening to protect critical national infrastructure that's not being done?
It does feel that way.
Mm.
But we've been talking for a while about attacks on industrial control systems and operational technology and the parts of a critical infrastructure business. And for the uninitiated, by critical national infrastructure, we would include utilities and energy supply. We'd include government bodies. We'd include the NHS in this country. We'd include telecoms networks like BT's. And logistics and food transportation and so on. Supermarket distribution could also count in that. The thing is, a lot of these systems are very bespoke and specialist and built often a long time ago for very specific purposes. We're not talking about someone's SAP installation or someone's Salesforce cloud, although these companies will all operate that as well. By targeting industrial control systems and critical infrastructure, malicious actors can hit old, unpatched, vulnerable systems much more easily than they can a fully patched Office 365 server. That's not to say that these companies aren't also leaving their Office 365 servers completely vulnerable, because many of them are. And there's a school of thought, a great deal of speculation this week, that Colonial Pipeline may have been attacked through a Microsoft Exchange server.
And it was attacked by, I may have got this wrong, is it the Dark Side?
Dark Side is the the ransomware group behind the attack. We're now fairly certain that that's the case. They're a Russia-based group, as many of them tend to be. And they're a keen adopter of the ransomware as a service model, whereby they hire affiliates to do the dirty work and then collect the money.
And the SolarWinds attack, that was Cozy Bear.
SolarWinds attack, yeah, APT29, also known as Cozy Bear. All the threat researchers will have their own designations for these groups, so it can sometimes be hard to keep them straight. But Cozy Bear is my preferred name, because I quite like it. Now, Cozy Bear is linked to the SVR, the Russian Intelligence Service, one of the KGB's successor organizations. So they are state-backed. So when you are getting hit by Cozy Bear, you are getting hit by Russian state intelligence, most likely. Whereas DarkSide, not so much of a connection to the Kremlin, if any. They will purely be a financially motivated cyber criminal organization.
Yeah, it's just commercially oriented. But they have this sort of affiliate model. So they make the software and then other people rent it.
Yeah, and they will advertise it on dark web forums, and people will sign up to, to affect the compromises. And yeah, it's all very, it's like you're buying software as a service. You'll get a cut, you'll pass a cut onto them. DarkSide, interestingly, this week were almost apologetic in a funny way for the Colonial Pipeline attack. They put out statements saying we don't want to cause problems, we just want money, which I felt begged the question, well, what did they think they were doing if not causing problems? There's a fundamental misunderstanding of the nature of crime. They seem, reading between the lines, it looks like one of their affiliates bit off more than the group was prepared to chew.
Okay.
And they're now trying to distance themselves from that in the hope that, because, you know, the US government is involved and taking this very seriously. You've got Joe Biden getting up there and making statements about it. So I think they're running scared, so to speak, which is a good thing. They should be. Interesting to see that story unfold this week, and it's still unfolding today.
I think I've just found my line of defense in my next appraisal as well. I'm not here to cause problems. I just want money. So that's useful as well.
Yeah, take that into your annual review.
Yeah.
But don't they have a kind of Robin Hood element, or as part of their propaganda that they...
Last year, they tried to make a couple of donations in Bitcoin to two charities in the United States. I'm just looking up what charities they were. Children International, which is based in Missouri, and the Water Project, which is a clean water artesian well project.
No, good causes.
They made two payments of 0.88 Bitcoin, which was at the time approximately $10,000, through an organization called The Giving Block, which is an entity that manages crypto donations to charity. And the group even posted the tax receipts for their donations. They said in a blog post at the time that it was only fair that some of the money they'd extorted from their targets should go to charity. The charities didn't accept the donations. It should go without saying. The Giving Block, the organization that manages the crypto donations, investigated and so on. It was all locked down fairly swiftly. But it speaks to an interesting tendency among these groups to not see themselves as criminals. And back to that, we don't want to cause problems statement. There have been other cybercrime ransomware groups that have effectively see themselves as penetration testers, freelance unscheduled penetration testers. the people who fleeced Fatface, the fashion retailer, earlier this year, went so far after concluding their negotiation with the organization to offer them some advice on how they could patch their systems and avoid this happening to them in future.
That's very
very helpful. Kind of them, but they also got away with £2 million. So you could have engaged an ethical service, like HackerOne any number of cyber firms, for much less than £2 million. So I wouldn't advise the unscheduled penetration test as a valid investment.
Yeah, getting involved with these people at all. And at the conference as well, the Cybersecurity Council?
Yes, the UK Cybersecurity Council is currently in the process of setting up, taking charge of skills and skills development for the cyber profession in the UK. The objective here is to effectively make cyber a well-regulated, professionalised, accredited sector. So as an accountant, we'll have their ICAEW qualifications and to kind of elevate the profession, elevate the trade is their mission.
Good luck to them.
It's quite exciting. They had a few hiccups when they launched. Our colleagues over at the register picked up on that because there was a problem with their domain name registration, which was probably a little embarrassing for them, but never mind. But I think it could be an interesting development. And I'm interviewing the chair of the board of trustees, Claudia Natanson, who is herself a former CISO, number of companies that she's worked at over the years. I don't remember which ones offhand, I'm afraid, but we shall see what she has to say about it in the near future.
Hopefully not just yet another attempt to professionalise the information security profession, of which there have been a few.
They have the full support of the government, and the NCSC in the venture. Matt Warman came along, the digital minister, came along to the conference virtually, obviously, and spoke very encouragingly about it. Again, these things often tend to have government backing, don't they? We shall see. You know, I remember DCMS statements from when I was covering broadband.
Yeah,
their grand announcements and grand plans that were forever being re-announced and then re-announced again. Mm. Re-announced again earlier this week, I think, if Joe's reporting is anything to go by. We'll see.
Yeah, we shall see. Yeah, we shall see. I remember when the Institute for Information Security Professionals was launched in, I think, 2006, just before I joined Computer Weekly. So yeah, it'd be around then. There's been a few of these things over the years, but I'm sure this one's got a very specific mandate. Mm.
Well, when Warwick and I were talking about the handover before I became security editor, and in 2019, he was quoting Bible verse at me, actually. He said that there, I forget the full text of the verse, but there is nothing new under the sun. What is will be again. And it's kind of the mantra that Warwick said he'd lived by in security for many years, and I know exactly what he meant.
Yes, I remember Warwick saying to me, Brian, he said, nothing ever changes.
Nothing ever changes, and we all go around again. It was a Delamitri song on the subject, wasn't it?
Well, thank you for that, Alex. But if there's something that you love even more than security is bees.
Absolutely.
They do make the world go round. You know,
they're incredibly important and they are incredibly imperiled.
Yes. And no one knows that more than, strangely, the Irish data centre community, who have decided to take it upon themselves to do their bit to help repopulate the country with bees. Yeah, we've spoken on the podcast loads of times before about the efforts that data center owners and operators are putting into making their server farms sort of more energy efficient, and the stuff that the industry is doing as a whole to be, you know, a bit more sustainable and environmentally friendly and all that. And those conversations have typically focused on the sort of commitments and pledges they've made, say various colocation companies and hyperscale cloud firms have made, I should say, to, you know, cut their energy usage and their carbon emissions, and while throwing weight behind sort of renewable energy projects and stuff like that. You know, that makes sense with our increasingly digital economy powered by these huge power hungry data centers. You know, there is a genuine need to make sure economic activities and growth are not coming at the cost of the environment. But the Irish data centre market has found itself at the centre of those kind of discussions quite a lot in recent years, in response to concerns that have been raised in the past about the environmental impact of its transformation, the country's transformation, into a thriving co-location hyperscale data centre hub. As you may or may not remember, many of the objections raised against Apple's now abortive attempt to build a data centre in County Galway several years ago were to do with environmental issues. The data centre industry over there has made a concerted effort on sustainability matters since then to avoid other data centre builders suffering a similar fate and having their projects cancelled. So again, we've seen various players out in Ireland with data centres sort of make big carbon reduction pledges and promises to ramp up their use of renewables as well. As I said, they're sort of now moving into another phase of this work. And it's not one that I've, as somebody covers the sort of global data centre market generally, their green push is now going into an area I've not seen anyone else really move into, which is around biodiversity, with, as we said, like a specific emphasis on growing Ireland's native bee and pollinator populations. So spearheading all this is an organisation called Host in Ireland, who are, I guess, they're sort of like a trade body, or I don't know, like a body that's sort of set up to sort of champion Ireland as like a good place for data centre operators to sort of set up shop. So they're really about trying to encourage overseas investment in Ireland in data centres. Yeah, they've collaborated with this organisation called the National Biodiversity Data Centre. Data centre is a separate word in that case. So I don't know if it was like, hey, there's a data centre. Maybe it's Host in Ireland. We should be courting with them. And this is all a bit of a mix up. They didn't realise, oh shit, actually, they're going to talk about bees. We thought they might want to set up a server farm. So I don't know if maybe that's like a little side story that will come out once this project's off the ground a bit more. So they've collaborated to create this 20-page DC for bees pollinator plan, which outlines sort of these various steps that the data centre industry in Ireland can do to make their sites more hospitable for pollinators, given that one third of Ireland's 98 wild bee species are now facing extinction, I found out while writing this story. So this advice that's in this 20-page document is calling on sort of data centre operators to sort of make a conscious choice with their facilities, you know, to let parts of their sites, you know, rewild by reducing frequency with which, you know, areas where there's grass, you know, cut the number of times a week or month, whatever, that's mowed. So you get like wildflowers growing, stuff like that to encourage, you know, the bees like. And they're also being encouraged to use any underutilized outdoor spaces at their data centers to put up hanging baskets, window boxes, plant out flower beds, all in the name of attracting bees. And also to create habitats where bees will be able to nest and make a home for themselves on these data centers. I wrote the story on it a couple of weeks ago, but I just think it's, like I say, it's another string to this whole sort of sustainability push that we've seen data centers get on. And it's just I've not heard anyone do this before. We've definitely done stories from a tech perspective on different projects that research teams are doing and the technology they're using to track bee populations, but I've not seen anything like, oh, tech firms, go and build a flower bed, you know, do your bit, put things back. I just thought it's quite an interesting.
No, it is interesting. Development.
And I mean, given as well the huge plots of land that data centers take over, I think from a PR perspective, at least, it's a great look for the people involved. You know, it's good to see them, that there is a plan in place to sort of put back something to make up for the sort of natural habitats, but a lot of these data center developments will inevitably lead to the destruction of, basically.
Yeah, I remember last year, World Bee Day, which was the 20th of May. I don't know if it's the 20th of May.
Oh, it's quite timely. Is it an annual thing? It might come out same day.
I don't know whether it's a different day each year, but it was SAS did put out a release about that. But that was more, Caroline, to do with like analysing what bees do and stuff, rather than kind of proactive attempts by tech companies to encourage the health of bees and, you know, have more bees because there are not enough bees and it's a problem.
They've got quite a lot of support for it. All 40 of Hosting Ireland's data centre partners have pledged their support for it. And that includes everyone from the major players in co-location, such as CyrusOne and Equinix. Yeah. But there's also other partners as well. They've got a lot of legal firms, real estate consultancies who are partners with Hosting Ireland. They've also said, okay, we'll do our bit as well. Also mechanical engineering and data centre design firms. So this might actually extend beyond just data centre sites. It could be, I don't know, CBRE's head office. You know, hey, have a flower bed or something. And what they've said as well, there's in this DC for bees pollinator plan, like I said, there's the the actual practical tips, but they're also saying as well they hope that this initiative will inspire other industries to follow suit and do their bit to save the bees as well. Because a big bit of this pollinator plan is sort of advocacy sort of focus, whereby they've sort of said to data center operators, you know, can you sort of tell your supply chain partners what you're doing here? You know, this is me just imagining a conversation that's going on. You know, someone pulls up at their facility to drop off a load of servers, and they say, "Oh God, like you need to mow your lawn." It's, "Oh no, we're actually doing this for the bees." You know, it's talk about it. Yeah. You know, get other, and they've sort of said as well, you know, businesses that are local to your data centers, get them involved, let the council, local councils know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And tell them to sort of adopt the principles of this plan as well. And yeah, you know, it's actually inspired me to do my bit as well. I'm going to start demanding, once the world returns to normal, that, you know, any invite I get to go on a data center tour must include a written commitment to let me survey their wildflower meadows, their window boxes, yeah, and their bee hotels, or otherwise I'm not going. That's what I've decided.
A few places are letting unused areas of land rewild themselves at the moment. We've got some round my way where the, you know, verges are just being left uncut and so on to encourage this sort of thing. So it's nice to see that this is happening when you, like you say, you've got these vast buildings with perfectly manicured lawns that nobody's doing anything else with surrounding them.
Now we've got a similar thing where I live. Hillingdon Council have Hillingdon in Bloom, which is a great gardening festival. But yeah, part of that is that there's various purposefully planted out wildflower grass verges along roads. Yeah, just places you can't get to. So what's the point in, like you say, just manicuring them? It just may as well be used for a positive purpose. And it's nice to see. And yeah, I hope it does some good. And it'd be good if you do see other people, not just Irish businesses and data centres, sort of following suit as well, because I do think it's a good initiative. I don't know, you do worry, there's so many vents around data centres, you know, it might end up turning into huge beehives or something, just where the bees get a bit, oh, this looks nice and airy, well, a bit warm.
I'm trying to think if there's a cyber angle for bees, but I'm struggling to come up with one. I don't think they really need protection from cyber criminals. People don't extort bees.
No, but you are a fan of the bee.
I first wrote about them for Computer Weekly 6 years ago, if you can believe it, when I wrote about an IoT project that was researching colony collapse disorder.
Thank you for that, Caroline. Now, Alex, as we said there, is a fan of the bee, but he's also a mapping enthusiast. He's into maps, and we treat our guests well on this podcast, which kind of dictated to some extent my choice of story, which is a story about how the British Red Cross used digital mapping and data sharing, come back to this sharing theme, to alleviate the COVID-19 pandemic crisis. So I wrote an article about this, which is on the website. We're also running it in the current issue going to press. It's based on an interview I did with a couple of guys, Adam Rowlands, who's Director of Digital at the British Red Cross, and Alexei Schwab, who's the Senior Information Manager at an organisation called, which is going to be very important for this story, the VCSEP, which stands for Voluntary and Community Sector Emergencies Partnership. And obviously there's some software involved in this, and their supplier is Esri UK, should mention them, and their product ARC GIS software. GIS stands for Geographic Information Systems. So the software in this, and there's digital mapping, but there's also kind of methods of data sharing, ways of collaborating, and open source models that have been developed by the Red Cross in emergency situations abroad. But the gist of it is they've come back to be used in the COVID-19 crisis in the UK. Incidentally, the Red Cross does 90% of its work is domestic. And that's true of all the sister organisations of the Red Cross and Red Crescent movement. They're very embedded with governments. but a lot of their expertise is developed in emergency situations abroad, the global south, as we were speaking about earlier. And the thing is the way kind of Adam explained this to me, is that if you land in a disaster zone, it kind of concentrates the mind. That's my paraphrase of it. But you have to collaborate. So they have a kind of cluster model within emergency relief, where the British Red, the Red Cross and Médecins Sans Frontières and all the others will have their own specialisms. And the British Red Cross has developed, one of its specialities is information management. So that's one of the things that they will bring to bear, like on an emergency situation. Data accuracy is really important in crises like this, especially geographic information, because you need to know where you are, where things are. Now, in the UK, well, and other countries too, all over the world, obviously with the COVID-19 pandemic, you've had this catalyzing effect. And we've spoken about this in Computer Weekly in terms of the pandemic across a whole range of technologies, but it has had the effect of kind of intensifying data collaboration efforts because there is a crisis. So this VCSEP organization originally came out of another couple of crises to do with the Grenfell Tower disaster and also the terrorist attacks in London and in Manchester in 2017. So that's where it comes from. And it's basically a network of organisations that the British Red Cross is one of the movers in it, but it's not the only one. So there's the Salvation Army, St John's Ambulance, local councils, charities, mosques. It's about 250 organisations that are involved in the VCSEP. What COVID did was scale up that initial organisation, which is very interesting. And there's been a kind of, one of the interesting things about the story, which obviously readers can read and listeners can read in detail, is there is this sort of network effect where they all kind of know different stuff and they bring different stuff to bear. And you've got local organisations who know about their locality interacting with national organisations that have got a national picture and kind of bringing together different data sets. And one of the things that they've done is they've generated the British Red Cross a couple of maps. One's a response map, and another one's called a vulnerability index map. So my story's got a couple of links to these maps so you can explore them for yourself. So like the vulnerability index map, it's vulnerability to bad effects from COVID-19. So it's drawing on data sets that look at economic inequality, health inequality, things like that. Very interesting, worth exploring. And Adam's also explained to me that they use some of these maps themselves for their own internal operations. Something that he kept saying was it has to be operationally useful. So like some of the methods and the data sharing things that they do in the DRC, you know, when they're helping with an Ebola outbreak or something like that, they're not necessarily using the most sophisticated technology, but the methods that they have are, you know, very kind of, they have to be operationally useful, has to be useful. You know, you don't want to be sending a Médecins Sans Frontières team down a road that doesn't exist anymore and things like that. So, yeah, I think it's interesting the way their international work has come back to have value in the COVID crisis here. That was, you know, an interesting thing to hear about. A couple of the international things that are involved in, there's an interesting parallel here. They're involved in a thing called missing maps. And again, it's a collaboration model. So they're not the only people who contribute to missing maps. But missing maps is all about generating useful maps for like emergency workers on the ground. Because there are big parts of the world that are not mapped properly. So they will, you know, use a like an app to kind of map certain things and then feed them into a big map, a digital map, and they kind of build this up from the ground up. It's really interesting to look at. I mean, the best thing to do is go and have a look at these things. And then there's another thing they're involved in called the humanitarian data exchange, which is an open data, open source agglomeration of humanitarian databases and data stores. It's maybe a story for another day, but the Missing Maps one, I think is really cool, and it's data that, you know, is maybe not the sexiest of things, but the accuracy of the data is super important to all this work. So yeah, I mean, there is a techie piece to this, you know. So as I said, they're using Esri, but they've done a bit of a cloud migration. Cloud always comes up, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. It's the future.
And some, you know, because they've been using it on the desktop. So there's a mobile form factor aspect to some of the newer things that they're doing. Integration with Microsoft Power BI and to produce dashboards and things like that. But the thing that Adam and Alexei came back to was that's not the main thing. The main thing is setting up the agreements for data sharing. And that's about people in rooms or on Zooms, lawyers, data professionals, whatever. That's the really hard work, is to pull that together. And yeah, so that's what they're doing through this VCSEP organization. I mean, I didn't know anything about any of that. And concretely, they have been doing various, I mean, just to actually say what sort of stuff they've been doing: COVID-19 tests in care homes, delivering food to food banks, supplying laptops to schools. You know, it all has to be operationally useful at the end of the day. The point of it. I don't know if either of you written about these kind of emergency organizations. I think there used to be a thing called Telecom Sans Frontières.
Telecom Sans Frontières used to go in, well, I believe they still do, used to go into refugee camps and so on, or disaster zones, and set up emergency phone masts and so on. I did a very interesting little press trip down to, it was several years ago, but I'm probably still not allowed to tell you where it actually was. Suffice to say, it was within a cheap day return of London Waterloo, to visit AT&T, I believe it was, their disaster response centre, from where they send out mobile communications and networking hubs to disaster areas all over the world. They'd responded to the big earthquake in Chile a few years ago, among many other things, but also to floods in the UK and other stuff. And from this secret location, they can, you know, have a network in a truck or a shipping container ready to fly within hours.
Yeah, it is interesting to hear the behind the scenes kind of stuff on all this, because obviously you see it on the news, but, you know, say these big bad awful events happening, and then you don't really, just because obviously it is a humanitarian crisis, you don't think about how do you get aid there, how do you get how are these networks working, all that kind of thing. So it's nice to have a peek behind the curtain to see this infrastructure you just don't even take into account, really.
Yeah.
What I will say is the map data, which I have had a little look at, particularly on the Red Cross COVID vulnerability map, you can layer it by all sorts of factors to get a real, and by, you know, down to local council wards in some cases, to get a real picture of how things correlate. I'm looking at West London just because it's where I am. My area and around Wandsworth considered at very low risk, but you can see how areas where, particularly out towards Heathrow, the shading gets a lot darker as you go out towards Slough and Heathrow. Many more people have. I live in a very undiverse part of London, but as you go out towards Hounslow and Slough, where there's, you know, big Asian communities, the risk level goes up alongside the.
There's a lot of knowledge to be derived from maps and mapping. Very, very simply being able to see things that are outside your own kind of vista, as it were. They are very interesting and useful things, and that whole thing of using maps and disaster zones and the missing maps as well to kind of fill in the picture and things like that, because One of the guys, I can't remember what the phrase was he used, I think it was something like the CNN effect, where, you know, everybody goes to like Nairobi and the problem isn't in Nairobi. You know, it's getting to where the problems are. And you can't do that unless you know where to go. It sounds very kind of simplistic to say it, but that just must be the case. Yeah, and Adam has quite a lot of experience in this area, working for Accenture, but for NGOs and governments in Africa and Asia and the Global South, which is a phrase that he used. Oh, just as a matter of course, Alex. So I know this came up in our group chat this week about using the Global South as a term. You know, it was just his term that he used very naturally.
I'm looking at the Missing Maps website. They're actually doing a mapathon in London next week. Virtual mapathon.
Something for our listeners maybe to get going on. Well, look, as usual, we'll provide links to all the stories that we've discussed today in the article that goes with the podcast, and you can read that summary on computerweekly.com. But you can also subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. And it always amuses me to thank Amazon Music, so you can ask Alexa for us. And you can still ask Alexa, who is H? Mother of God. So sadly, I think that's all we've got time for this week. Thank you very much indeed, Alex, for joining us today.
Thank you for having us. It's been a pleasure.
Good to have you back on after slightly more than a year. And as ever and always, thank you very much to Caroline.
You're welcome.
And thank you to you, listener, very much for listening and getting all the way to the end. Stay safe. Bye-bye.
Bye.